Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey guys, welcome to part two of my conversation with Sherelle, Judy Griffith and Mary Ann Hobbs. In part one, you heard about our journeys, and in part two, we're taking a deep dive into the music industry and discussing sexism, whitewashing, and so much more. Let's get back into it. I'd love to ask you all, when you were coming up, like, did you have female role models? Because I know, Sherelle, you talked about DJ Rashad and DJ Spin and, you know, a lot of male figures. And again, like, we can't help but acknowledge the how it is a male-dominated industry, especially, you know, a few years ago. Yeah, but were there people when you're coming up who were female that you could look to for inspiration?
Well, obviously you, Mary, and then Annie Mack.
Mm.
But that's like for broadcasting.
Yeah.
In terms of working out whether people were, you know, women and they were producers, I think I didn't have I wasn't in the mindset to work out, oh, this must be a woman or a man. I mean, it only dawned on me when I was like talking about people or thinking about people and looking up what Machine Drum looked like, because he's another influence to me. I was like, okay, cool. Rashad, okay. Cool.
Yeah.
There's a lot of amazing people within footwork who are women. Jana Roche is like an amazing person. There's quite a few, obviously, trans artists within footwork as well. Jay Lynn. And then in Jungle, I've got the likes, obviously, of like Storm and Chemistry, DJ Flight. But with regards to the Jungle side, knowing their presence was a lot later, after I was obviously doing my copious amounts of like research, obviously, of the genre, and in the footwork side of things, I would have come across people via like SoundCloud and stuff, but there's plenty of other names, unfortunately, like Jam Francisco or Anna Winkler or Fresh Till Death. These are all footwork producers which don't necessarily have the same press given to them, but there's plenty of them. It was a hard one. I think, you know, myself and you are maybe fortunate in the sense of how we've come into it, and there's obviously a lot more of us to see now. Yeah. Even though we do still, you know, we're having a conversation outside, still recognizing, understanding what we need to do, obviously, to make sure that legacy wise, that obviously transfers over to like different people and like who are we bringing in? Because I guess the next group of people that we need to make sure is obviously women and then obviously trans acts and artists as well. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, growing up, you don't necessarily have that. So if you've only got Mary or Annie.
That's exactly true, because I didn't really have any, like, another generation lower than you, a couple of generations like lower than you. But so for me, it was like mainly male mentors, I guess, because I just didn't see any women in the spaces that I was really kind of interested in. They might have been there, but they were probably behind the scenes. And you know what? It's mad, because before I actually worked for Strictly Rhythm, as I said earlier, it was a label that I collected a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to be like, you know, obsessed with the vinyl. And as I said, look at every little piece of it and read everything. And on the Strictly Rhythm records, it used to say A&R by Gladys Pizarro. And I was just like, oh my God, is this a real person? Is this like, you know, it's like a female, but you didn't have sort of social media, so you never got to see what people looked like. Everyone was faceless back then, you know? So it was just like, she was just like this anonymy. I used to always like think, oh my goodness, if she is a real person, then she's doing A&R. It's like, I never used to read a female name doing A&R on any record that I had in my collection. It was like the only one-on-one I saw. And I was just like, you became obsessed with Gladys Pizarro. And it was just a name. I never, you know what I mean? I didn't know anything about this woman. But I was just like, she was like kind of like my thing. She made me think that you could have a record label. You could actually sign music and do those kind of things. Like, she in a way was a kind of mentor to me without her even really knowing it. Like, you know, when I actually eventually ended up working there, that was like a shock, you know. And then I met her in person and I was like, wow, you don't even realize what you did to me before you were even, a live person in my head, you know. But she kind of was the only one. Like, everybody else was kind of male, which is sad, really. But that's just the way it was then, wasn't it? There was just not really any female role models doing the jobs that I do, you know.
Yeah. Was it the same for you, Marianne?
When I was about 15 and a half, I got thrown out of my own home for various different reasons. And I spent some time living with this fantastic woman, and her name was Anne Oldroyd. And she had a house that was in a village that was kind of adjacent to where we were in Lancashire at that point. And she was the most remarkable woman. And she took in all kinds of waifs and strays. There were a couple of lads that I knew really well who were living in a foster home close by, and that didn't work out for them. And she took them in at the same point at which she took me in. And there wasn't a stick of furniture in this house. There was no carpet on the floor, no paint on the walls, nothing, you know. But she welcomed us in and she said, you know, I haven't got very much here, but you're, you know, you can share what it is that I do have. And she was amazing. You know, she was seeing a guy who, I don't know, he ended up in Preston prison. And I remember I'd go in the car with her to go and visit him in Preston prison. And she used to sneak in these Farah trousers. They were like these crimpoline trousers. You probably remember them, don't you? With a stay press pleat down the front, which were, I don't know, for some reason, it was really important to have these to trade in prison. And my job was to sit in the car. And she used to buy me a beef chow mein with cashew nuts in it. And I remember it was the first time I'd ever tried a cashew nut. And I thought, wow, this is life changing, you know. But she was the most remarkable woman. And the way that I could, I guess, contextualize it is that she was entirely free and she accepted you for everything that you were. She didn't really ever ask even any questions or put any pressure on you. I was riding motorbikes at that point and I don't know. Getting into all kinds of scrapes, but she just let me be and she gave me the confidence that I needed, I think, to kind of just pursue these crazy adventures that I ended up on, as I described a bit earlier, you know, when I ran away to London and lived on the bus. But yeah, her name was Anne Oldroyd and she was like a beacon of light for me when I was a kid. Yeah. So yeah.
It's important to have those role models, I think. Yeah, whether if it was the lady you've described who was so important to you, or even if you can, like you described, when you see someone like a Marianne Hobbs or Annie Mack who on the radio that you can be like, because I remember listening to Annie's show on Fridays and being like, just hearing like a female voice playing electronic music on the radio, like it made me think, oh, maybe I can actually do that.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing.
I will mention that another person, but it's obviously, he's a guy, it's Mr. Jam as well.
Mm, yeah.
So for me, seeing Mr. Jam be a black DJ playing electronic music, in which I was into, especially within the dubstep days, hearing him do his side of things there, it was really cool for me because I was like, oh, wow, he's playing all different types of music that I'm, you know, into and whatever. And it's like that representation was also super key as well.
Yeah.
Because I guess, you know, with regards to like broadcasting, you don't necessarily see that on maybe mainstream radio as much, which I guess it's a lot better now, but obviously still could...
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. And I wanted to touch on this is like, representation in electronic music, because there's so many, especially after last year with the Black Lives Matter movement, like really pushing to the forefront. There have been now like so many dialogues about the whitewashing of electronic music and representation of people of color on lineups. We've all seen it. We've all spoken about it. And, you know, I kind of want to talk about, you know, in fact, even here, going back to last year, I did an article with my friend Helena Starr, and we did an article about the Mobos and how there's no, at the moment and for years, there's no acknowledgement of electronic music on the programme, which feels wrong considering electronic music's roots and all the amazing black artists making electronic music that are out there. So when they started in the mid-90s, Jungle and Garage were acknowledged. Goldie won Best Album, I think, in 96, and I think
Fabian Grooverider, and there are a few, you know, names that were categorized, but then it kind of dropped off, you know, turn of the 2000s. And I wanted to just have this conversation with you guys in the room about this representation or lack of for Black people in electronic music.
The way I've always seen it, I think, was obviously just like touched on, like, artists naturally, especially in the electronic music scene, were essentially faceless. So if you were buying vinyl, you would just see their names, Marshall Jefferson. Yeah. And like, I mean, you know, I would be like, yeah, okay, cool. But like, other people wouldn't necessarily know.
Yeah.
And I think when you're moving into an age then where maybe you've got, say, for instance, publications might put people on covers, or, you know, they're writing about people, and then you start to see their pictures, then I guess without realising, people are starting to move towards a scene in which, obviously, then, I don't know, they want to make it more marketable in that sense.
I totally agree. That's exactly what I was at the point that I was going to say. It's like, I think that the whitewashing of the industry came along as soon as we had to be more visible, as social media and all that came along. Because if I look at the club, I've been there for sort of 20 years. So in the first 10 years, if you look at the programming, there's females, there's LGBTQ community, there's everybody being represented across the lineups. And then you look at the last decade and it's mainly white men. Mm. And it's like, what happened in that last decade? And it was because, as I said, we used to book people. I never used to know what they looked like until they turned up at the club half the time. Do you know what I mean? Because it weren't booking of how popular someone was. It literally was on how they DJed, what the quality. Didn't matter what they looked like or what gender they were. It wasn't something that you even asked or even thought about. Mm. You just booked, you know? I was bringing a lot of Black artists over from America as well. And, you know, they were all being represented at the club. But then all of a sudden, when we had to be more visible and people wanted to write articles about you and stuff like that, and like, you know, maybe people of colour doesn't sell, it's not, you know, you're not going to have a Black artist on the front of your magazine. That was not norm, you know. It was like, you're lucky if you could have something in the charts. I remember crying when Soul to Soul got to number one. I know it's really mental, but it was the first time, because we used to go to their parties at Africa Centre, and they were kind of like part of our community. And it was the first time that we'd sort of seen someone from our community in a commercial chart. It seems bizarre now because it's just quite norm. But it just, that kind of thing was not happening. You wouldn't see it. Even working at Strictly Rhythm, you'd have like a dance track, and We in the UK office, we used to have to get things licensed because it was an American label. Mm. So we'd have to license things to UK label. You know, they would never pick something up, or they would ruin it and sort of change it, like, so that it sounded much more, not less soulful or less Black kind of thing, in order for it to have commercial success. There'd be all these brilliant songs like that we were getting through Strictly Rhythm, great vocals, couldn't get them licensed for love or money because the artist was Black and they didn't want to show them, you know what I mean? And yeah, I definitely totally 100% agree that it was down to the social media and sort of just having more visibility was why people stopped booking that kind of thing. You know, it's definitely a massive factor from my experience and what I've seen. Yeah, people didn't want to do interviews with certain people. A lot of the pioneers that we were bringing over, suddenly people didn't want to do things.
I've got more bits to say, but Mary, did you have anything to add?
Do you know, I'm just thinking about a conversation that I had in the aftermath of Black Lives Matter. And it was a chat that I had with a really close friend of mine called Femi Colioso, who's a drummer in Ezra Collective.
Yeah.
And we had a really long conversation about many different aspects. And we talked for a number of hours about mentoring and actually how important mentoring is. And Femi said one thing to me as part of that conversation that stuck with me. And he said, can you imagine how different the world would be if every single young person had a mentor, you know, and a helping hand to offer them some support and said, come on, I'll help you with that. Mm. I'll give you a hand up. And, you know, Femi does a lot as a drummer. I think all of you know that he does a lot of free lessons as a drummer. And I have sort of, in the aftermath of that conversation, invoked a couple of other different mentoring projects. And I just think what Sherelle is doing is so incredible in terms of world building with Beautiful, the project that she's just announced. And I feel, to a degree, it's up to all of us to figure out how we can empower the next generation, isn't it? that's the way forward, yeah. I think, for me. And it's about sharing the experience and the knowledge and the love and that sense of encouragement that you can give to a young person and showing them that actually you can build a different pathway. Yeah. And I think all of us can be part of that. And I would love for Sherelle to talk to us about
this. Yes, I really, really want to know about this. It looks sick.
Obviously, you discussing about like whitewashing, essentially something obviously I was thinking about when we've had countless conversations at Mixmag, Jesus Christ. Like, we would sit there and talk about various different ways or, you know, articles. I've helped in articles with Jaguar before about certain stuff, especially when it comes to the LGBTQI side of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, going back to obviously what was just been said, you know, the whitewashing side of at least Jungle anyway is insane.
Yeah.
Because obviously taking out specific, you know, samples out to make it seem more white. The conversation around like IDM, I had Square Pusher recently in for the residency. And he was talking about how he feels deeply uncomfortable about the fact of that the name itself, IDM. And essentially what it could have stood for in terms of like, I guess the person who created it didn't realise like maybe in the back of their mind that they were essentially, you know, intelligent dance music.
Yeah.
Even though the historically, obviously where it's coming from and all this kind of stuff, it leads to, say, for instance, like jungle and breakbeat and hardcore and stuff like that. Knowing all of that kind of history makes me super sad. You know, you've got amazing trailblazers at the likes of like Reinforced Records, who I think don't get enough love or attention in comparison to other counterparts, considering how much they helped people, what their parties did for people. You know, a Young Goldie, for instance, you know, designing their logos and stuff like that and whatever, and getting the inspiration for his own label through obviously their work and the stuff that they did, and like the instrumentation, obviously them moving from all the various different aliases they have of like Mannix to like Four Hero is insane. And then Ronnie Size as well, which I believe is, you know, he's had a lot of, at least, you know, back in the day, had a lot of, you know, awards, you know, a Mercury Music Award and all this kind of stuff and whatever. That's on, obviously, that was on Giles's label, I believe. Yeah, I think so, yeah. And all of these things are amazing historical things, but there is, you can see a point in Jungle where it kind of just peters off and then goes into, you know, drum and bass and like amazing initiatives. Like, say, for instance, EQ50, which is run by DJ Flight and Mantra, obviously are doing things to counteract that. For me anyway, like, I love music. I love the history of music. I've always been intrigued about what whitewashing has done to music.
Yeah.
Being one of the very few people, if not maybe one of the only few people, in my school that was really interested in dance music made me kind of, I was uncomfortable to say that I really liked Disclosure. And it's, you know, really? It's like Disclosure. Yeah, because I, you know, when I'm in school in Woodford, if already there's a disparity of how many people in Woodford, just to obviously clarify for everyone listening at home, Woodford is a place in Essex and also London. So part of it is like in London, part of it's in Essex. Majority white. And the school I went to was majority white. And at the time I was going to school, you were into only very few fair genres. And if you were, as a black person said, that you were interested in electronic music, they would consider you to be more white than it would be black.
Because of the music.
Because of the music. And the music, with regards to their interpretation and the representation of music at the time, at least, when they look at dance music, they think it's only white people. I love, you know, Chemical Brothers. I love Basement Jacks. I love Daft Punk. But these are the people that I like, was like obsessed with, especially like Digital Love music video and all this kind of stuff and whatever. But I get why my counterparts in terms of age range would think it's white, because the only faces you are seeing on the TV for dance music in terms of big dance music, like a Fatboy Slim as well, are white. Whereas I knew, I felt uncomfortable. I was like, no, but the singers, the things that I'm listening to, they don't, I can sense the origin, like I can feel it, like almost, like, do you know what I mean? Like, so when finally understanding Strictly Rhythm, or like, you know, going, finding their bits and going, oh my God, these are all the bits that I was listening to from young because of an aunt or, you know, my mum or whatever, makes you super happy, because you're like, okay, cool, sick. And then when you start to do your research even more, and then you're going into Chicago and in places like Detroit, and you're like, wait, hold up.
How is it
How is this moved on from where it's moved on to? And it's naturally, obviously, like I said, people were nameless, eventually moved into periods of obviously, you know, having to market themselves, unfortunately, we're all very aware it doesn't matter if it's music or sports or anything. Unfortunately, there is marketing issues there, obviously, which if you're, you know, if you are, you are white, you probably, you know, go further with regards to marketability. Going back to Beautiful, the idea, obviously, with the label and the essentially initiative was that thinking over Black Lives Matter stuff, which for me, I was always in two minds about, because obviously Black Lives Matter this time round isn't necessarily the first time round. Yeah. That's the thing that kind of makes me go, oh, it hasn't been the first time this has been spoken about. They've, you know, shut down airports with, you know, protests and stuff like that in the UK. And it was seen as like this, how dare they do such a thing? Black Lives Matter, all lives kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? And they've been doing it for years. It's created by Black queer people. And I think obviously having the thought process, having the time to be off, worried about countless other things, you know what I mean? You know, I was learning to do production on the basis of controlling my own anxiety about whether we were going to go back out again. And then being in that mindset anyway was like a super weird thing to be in. And it just dawned on me basically, yeah, like if you're unaware of, say, for instance, the history of what dance music or electronic music is, how are you able to counteract the some of the stuff that goes on? Because it's all well and good people be like, oh, but you know, I don't see color, or I, you know, but you know, let's use Ricardo Villalobos. Ricardo Villalobos has been doing it for years, and and it's like, well, actually no, because he might have not known he's actually influenced by X, Y, and Z. You know, well, what about Kraftwerk? Well, actually Kraftwerk have been also influenced by X, Y, and Z in terms of like James Brown and soul music and stuff like that before they got onto, you know, doing electronic music and all this stuff. If you don't know that stuff, then obviously if someone says all these things to you, then you don't know how to counteract back. And I think that's the issue. So with Beautiful, at least in workshops anyway, for younger, well, not too young actually, because with Represent, I learned that actually there's a lot of age ranges that need to be addressed. So from 18 upwards, I don't think I'm going to have an age limit on it, to be honest with you, because it depends on what's going on in your life. But people need to be able to be educated about the history of dance music as a whole, certain genres and how they trickle down. Some people might not even realise that jungle has reference to techno, or, you know, like Kevin Sorderson, you know what I mean, all that kind of stuff. Teaching people about the connections will only, I think, personally make it stronger for the person to actually play their own music, talk about the music, talk about ways to counteract certain things, and then, you know, give them the confidence that they know much about their music to say, for instance, if they come across someone who might not understand things or might be bad about certain ways that apparently music is in dance, actually, no, because X, Y, and Z. And then obviously you have the production side of things, which, you know, we've been to Red Bull, you know, the meetups there and stuff like that. Like they always do, like, did at least anyway, like the production workshops, the DJ workshops. I'd like to do that, obviously, and get people the knowledge and the tools really to work that out. And then the label side of things is obviously just getting new and old together. So with this compilation, there's people that are completely unknown, with the likes of people who have been on really big labels and stuff like that and whatever, or have recently had success with amazing like albums and stuff like that. And then the next phase for me is that, you know, we sit here, you know, talking about maybe there's not enough women in music, there's not enough people of colour in music. How do we counteract lack of bookings? How do we counteract lack of representation? And it dawned on me again, was like, wait a minute, how many actual club owners of, like, within our scene are actually Black or POC?
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God, wait, okay, cool. So, you know, initially, yeah, I'm going to come out of label and now, yeah, I was going to do workshops. But then it dawned on me that a long-term plan I would like is for Beautiful to own clubs within like London and other places around, like in and around Europe, and then hopefully branch that out into the US. But the main thing is for me, like, I'm very concerned with legacy, very concerned with like community-based things. And I just want to preserve amazing work that's already been within our scene. I want to make sure that community is built and stays the way it is, because losing places like, you know, when you guys, you know, Fabric was lost for a bit and then came back, that was going to be a huge blow to the likes of everyone's music in this room, right? When smaller clubs, even like Birthdays, get shut down in Dalston, that's a huge blow to someone like myself, with regards to that's a lot of footwork nights went on there and in London. And
yeah,
there's like
small venues where small you can venues, put on your first ever club night.
And you know, some people might not come. I've definitely played to an empty room before. Do you know what I mean? It's fun because you've got a sound system to yourself. But it's about cultivating the genres and the scene and the people that come there, about building this tangible thing. which unfortunately has been lost within the UK and stuff like that. So with Beautiful, it would be nice to move into that space. I mean, I said it would be nice. We will move into that space, because I find myself sometimes saying stuff like that. But we will move into that space eventually, where there's a tangible place here that is safeguarded by myself, will be owned, black owned. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not going to, you know, be kicking people out, or, you know, this night can't go on here. I think some promoters really do, unfortunately, you know, take on nights and they might not necessarily believe in what they are doing. Yeah. And they know that it makes a lot of money, considering, you know, everything that's gone on recently. So I really want to counteract that, because I want to make sure that all feelings around stuff are, like, genuine and yeah, I desperately want it. I it will work. I will make it work.
Yeah,
because I think I'm just sick and tired of stuff. But in the same regards to you, obviously you're aware, you know, you're doing initiatives as well to make sure that people just get the right foot up. I think
I think what I like to see is that I feel like our generation is, even though, you know, we're kind of in our mid to late 20s, it's like we're already looking back at what we can improve for the future, which I think is quite, I don't know, I feel like it's quite a unique thing. I feel like I always say our generation is going to be the ones to, like, help save the world, because we kind of already thinking about how we can improve.
I totally agree. I feel like we sort of did the struggle and now we're kind of like getting older now. I just want to give stuff back. I just want to sort of share my knowledge and help to evolve other people and elevate other, you know, next generation. But it's like, you guys are super young and you're already got, like, a voice. And I feel it makes me really happy, actually, because it's like, I feel like we have slowly create an environment where women or young people kind of feel more confident to speak out. Yeah. Like, I probably wouldn't. I was quite silent. I was that person that was sort of kind of like hiding behind the scenes. I, you know, even doing things like this, I would sort of generally, I used to say no.
Really?
Because I hated being that visible person, and I hated being I would leave that to the artists and the, you know, to be the face of Fabric or whatever I was doing. I would leave it always up to somebody else. And I was sort of, I kind of was silent. I mean, and I feel really bad for that, because it's only in the last couple of years, and specifically as well last year with the George Floyd stuff and Black Lives Matter, that I've realised that, you know, visibility is sort of key. It's like, I didn't see people, and because I didn't see people in those positions, I felt in certain spaces, I felt like I wasn't welcome. So that means that other people are thinking that as well. And so it's really important for me to say, yes, I've actually been the person behind Fabric on Saturdays, or
and feel whatever, just the just importance to change,
yeah,
of your
to make
voice.
Someone else feel confident about doing it. You know, I need someone else to be my Gladys Pizarro, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I need to
be
that sort of thing. And I feel a bit gutted that it took me so long to have the confidence to sort of speak out and to realise the importance of it. But I just sort of feel like I kind of was like one of those people that sort of shrunk themselves almost, because I didn't want to be.
But it was a different time though, I think.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, people like you, Judy and Marianne, you know, you've created a space for us. You have, where, you know, I can do a podcast like this where we can have these open, honest and hopefully forward-thinking conversations to help change the world for the better, where Shez can set up her beautiful label and have the confidence to, you know, actually say how we feel and be like, you know, this isn't cool, this isn't right, and draw from our own experiences and want to make it a better place.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too hard on yourself either, because I can only imagine you potentially might have been one of very few black women within the music scene, which I think you... there is no way, and there's a lot of guilt I think we can feel as black and POC women to even speak up, or we should have done stuff or whatever. But I don't think I don't know, me and Jagoff are just very aware of obviously the times that we're in now, that we're able to say these things and actually be able to. My sister, you know, had unfortunately issues at her workplace, and you know, she's 40, and she had issues at her workplace where, you know, they took her and perceived her to be you know, a particular kind of person just based on race, and that didn't, I mean, it worked out for her in the best way possible, obviously, because actually she paid her job, but you know, it was things were different, and I just don't think you should ever be too hard on yourself, because even your general presence and making sure that, you know, you will always have in the back of mind, because of your experience, that who you're booking, who's coming in, who's coming through, you know.
Yeah, and just by being there and being in your role and what you've done, like, it just by being visible, that is something amazing, you know, to see other black girls and people of colour can look up to you and be like, oh, maybe I'll, you know, work at Fabric or in promotions or in events and at clubs, you know, that even that.
That's very rare.
Is amazing.
Yeah. Especially in promotions, I would say.
Yeah. It's very rare. I think as well, as sort of like, you have the problems as being a female, but then you have the problems that come on top of that of being black as well.
Sure.
And you know, it's this huge man's world. And sort of a lot of the time, sort of for me in the past, if I did speak up or if I did speak my actual truth, you know, I could be vilified for it. It's just, a lot of it's been, my progress has been at the expense of my own culture for the early days, you know, and I had to kind of almost quash some of that in order for me to move forward, like, which is really sad. Like, I'm like, you know, why should I have to sort of do that? But we kind of almost conditioned as we grow, as you grow up, sort of being, you get used to having to do those kind of things in order to move forward and ignore certain comments or little microaggressions, they call it now. But like, you know, you kind of ignore that and you get used to doing that as a black female or as a black person or a person of colour. You get used to sort of just going, okay, well, I want to save them. I don't want to say that about myself because I don't want that other person to be embarrassed or to feel awkward or anything, you know. So instead, I'll take the flak and I'll take it and I'll just sort of let them.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I'm just not going there anymore. I learned a lot during lockdown as well. And sort of the last few years, I've just really learned that it's time to sort of speak up and just to sort of tell people it as it is and not be so worried about what the consequences, because I know that I'm actually right and I should do. And the
and
only way
got
to
people who
to change
are gonna
things is to call
you.
Shit out, isn't it?
And you we're know? All going to back you. Like, yeah, this is the people, thing. Yeah. I feel like, you know, women in music and, you know, I feel like there is a strong kind of solidarity community.
Yeah.
Mariam, what about you and your experiences?
I just want to say what a remarkable orator you are.
Yeah.
What a powerful storyteller and what an inspirational journey you've had. You need to share this like all day,
every
day.
You should write a book.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. I'd read your book.
Well, if only I could remember half of it. I always need prompts and then I can just roll.
Yeah, it's remarkable though. Women of our generation have had all kinds of stuff said to them. I was thinking about a funny story that I could tell you. A very first remark that was made to me by somebody in a position of great power in an institution that is very famous. And I went to work for this particular place. And the first thing he said to me beyond welcome to this institution was, "Now then, is there any pornography we're going to need to buy back? Have you ever featured in any films or photographs that we're going to need to buy back so they don't end up in the press?"
What?
And I can laugh about that now, but I did think to myself at the time, you know, would you really seriously put that on the table as an opening gambit to a man?
That's outrageous.
You
know?
So
what did you say out of interest?
Wow.
I just laughed in his face, actually, and I said, "No, I don't think you need to worry on that score." But you'd be astonished at the types of things that kind of came in our direction as, I suppose, women of the same generation.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's just stuff that you just wouldn't say now, do you know what I mean? So PC, the stuff that I had to sort of take, you know? And also they sort of, or even sort of just in the early days of the club where, no, you know, people wouldn't see that I was the person that maybe was programming it and doing it. You know, they would always think I was what they saw as a lesser position, you know, and I'd sort of be in the booth or something and they'd go, "Oh, were you girlfriends or something like, you know what I mean?" And I'd be like, "No." And, you know, or are you just the person just going to get me drinks? Can you get me a drink? Can you, you know, just thinking you're kind of the lackey. They just cannot get their head around the fact that you are the sole person that's programming. It's like, and other people sort of always saying to me, "Oh, you know, this is someone else doing it with you." It's like, must be something. You must be just doing the logistics or something. You know, you can't be you actually booking the artist. It's like, it's not a female's job, you know? You're not meant to be a leader or anything.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I feel like women have been, unfortunately, sometimes always the background of, like, unfortunately, various subcultures. Thus meaning, just in general, obviously, through history, it'd be quite obvious why.
Yeah, pushed to the back.
But kind of pushed to the back or not necessarily the leaders. I know that there's obviously other subcultures, at least anyway, that's not the case. But it does feel that way in terms of history when you're looking at certain pictures or like who's the representation of that particular genre that unfortunately, you know, it just is the case.
Yeah, to add to that, like where this episode idea came from was off the back of an article I wrote for Mixed Mag last year about the unsung black women pioneers of house music that I wrote. Because I was thinking of things to write about and I was like, you know, you hear about all the male kind of pioneers and founders, the Belleville Three, Larry Levan, Frankie Knuckles, you know, all the greats. Mm. But it's like, where were the women? Like, there must have been women DJs there. And then I learned about Sharon White and I learned about Stacey Hot Wax Hale. And I spoke to Smoking Joe, I spoke to DJ Paulette from Manchester and Ultranate as well. Yeah. And it was like the craziest batch of interviews I've ever done. And it was a real labour of love. And the reach of that article, I'm so glad it's been out there because I've had people who've been in the industry for years, male, and they've like, I've never heard of any of these women. Like, well, they've probably heard of Ultranate, but they haven't heard of these women. And it was like, it took me, who was 25 at the time, to do my own research and write the article because no one else had. And I thought that was wild. And it does, from talking to them, it is like, why are women repeatedly written out of the narrative of history time and time again?
Yeah.
I don't know. Why?
It's a hard one. I mean, well, I guess it's just men have always been the leaders and we're in a male-dominated industry. And it's down to us now to sort of change things,
absolutely.
I guess. You know, I mean, nowadays, like, I think we're getting there. We've created an environment where women or people of colour can sort of start to share their stories with more confidence and know that they're going to get some kind of backup. And, like, you know, women and some men are calling shit out now. And, you know, you can feel a little bit more like that person's going to have my back if I say this. There's many a time where I feel like I've been in a meeting and been shouted down by a male person, like really shouting and screaming, and everybody's sat around me and no one's backing me up. And you're just
there's
like,
this weird unsaid thing amongst sometimes men that they don't necessarily call each other out for their shit.
Yeah.
Which always grinds my gears when I'm like on a night out and someone's friend has done something stupid.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And they're talking to me and it's like, no.
Talk to them.
Talk to them because they've just done something stupid. I think there's an element of, I guess, power that can come in with writing out women under the same breath. I feel, again, you know, coming from this generation, I actually generally in some parts probably think that actually some people really just didn't even notice all of these things happening and stuff like that and whatever, like the, you know, misogyny and now even misogynoir and like sexism didn't even realize they were being so because it was just so much a thing. You know, there's a lot of
Sort of normalized.
Yeah, a lot of normalization. Behavior, if you think about it, it's like generations to generations, generations, generations. You know, I can talk to my mum all day about, you know, how she feels about like racism and stuff like that and whatever. And, you know, she tells me some horrific stories. And then she looks at what's happening now and she's just like, well, you know, actually it's kind of moved on in a better way. And I'm sometimes like, what do you mean? It's
just,
it's become, well, it's obviously become, you know, racism has become more insidious and same thing with sexism and all this kind of stuff and whatever. But this element of, I don't know, we think that we're lucky, but I guess there's just natural improvement that just needs to keep happening until, you know, it doesn't.
Yeah, in some ways things improve, in some ways you go backwards.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? And even with, I kind of want to talk about sexual assault here, like with this podcast, I said off air, but with this podcast, the reason it became a thing is because last autumn, around the sort of time when there are allegations about Eric Murillo with sexual assault and that all coming to light, it was really like stressful time to be reading about it. And I just felt so compelled to put a podcast together with some women in the industry and just talk about and unpack that whole situation. And that was sort of the first ever Proto Utopia Talks episode leading to where we are here today. And it feels like kind of like we've spoken about, we are living in a world now where I think, you know, women and non-binary and people are speaking out about these experiences. And I think it's hard as well when you're in a male dominated industry that, you know, if something has happened to you in a club, whether it's sexual assault or feeling uncomfortable, etc., like it is really hard to have the confidence to come out and say something when you could be telling it to a bunch of guys and they might not understand or acknowledge or care.
How do I describe this? I've lost my shit countless times at men in the club on the behalf of friends, whether it be inappropriate dancing, not understanding when to leave, groping, you name it. It's things in which obviously I'm quite, you know, if anyone has seen the boiler room, you know, quite protective over space anyway, very protective obviously over my friends too. It's an interesting thing actually. My mum saw my sister recently with my little niece, and my mum saw my sister bend down, and she's like, oh gosh, your jumpsuit is too short, Charmaine, like, oh my god, like, you might want to change it. I was like, what's wrong? I was like, what's so short about it? She's like, oh no, you know, you don't want to attract, like, you know, attention from people and stuff like that. It's like a harmless comment, obviously. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, fair enough if it's, you know, short. But then it kind of dawned on me that she's saying it on the basis of protecting my sister because of potentiality of someone looking or touching or whatever. And I was saying to my mum, I was like, oh, like, no, I appreciate obviously what you're saying, mum, but you shouldn't probably say that to Charmaine, or at least you're like reinforcing, allowing this kind of behaviour. Like, what you're saying basically is saying that protect yourself from a guy, but the guy's going to do what, you know, they want. But that kind of thought process, I think, gradually, I think maybe our generation are weeding out because we don't kind of have those, we don't want to hear those kind of things. You know, even the school skirts. I once upon a time wore a skirt
with the hair.
Yes, with hair. Jaguar knows
I adore
that time when I had hair. But yeah, like wearing a skirt and stuff, and obviously people asking to roll it down, and I'm thinking in my head, I mean, come on, this is like, I can't show my knee.
It's like it's your fault.
It's my fault, yeah. And I think there's inherited kind of thought process of obviously as a woman or a non-binary person of how you're supposed to conduct yourself
for the
basis of the other person. And I think that just doesn't help also in a club situation, because then it might adhere, or you might change certain ways that you dress, or you might not want to necessarily feel comfortable in a club. One of the down points actually for the boiler room was that there was too many girls there. And there was loads of comments
commenting on
people commenting on the fact that there were so many girls there, and they were not happy about this, and they were trying to pinpoint certain things about the women that they didn't like about them and all this kind of stuff and whatever. And then, you know, on the flip side, obviously you've got, you know, people, you know, women and non-binary people that obviously are able to come to my gigs. When I do see them at the gigs, they're more in the front.
Yeah, because they feel seen, well, yeah, and they feel like they can be at the front.
I will, you know, naturally I will kick off obviously if anything does go down, but like, I'm happy to see that they feel like they can take the space up at the front, because,
yeah,
you know, that's not usually the case when you, you know, go to certain gigs and stuff like that and whatever. And I think there's a lot of behaviour that needs to be, I think, unlearned within our scene. I think clubs could be a lot safer. There is not necessarily such thing as a safe space, because obviously you're always going to get someone that's going to ruin that. But amazing things that I think BBZ have done with their club nights, or Pussy Palace, with regards to having people specifically there to make people feel comfortable, have been really helpful. I think the group that I'm very concerned about, especially as well going on nights out, are trans people, mainly because of the fact that, you know, if you're going out and you meet the wrong kind of crowd and stuff, so, you know, something bad can happen. There's plenty of deaths that have occurred for Black trans women within the US and stuff, which just is like absolutely like gross and disgusting, and it's not really being taken care of at all. And I think more can be done, obviously, to just make sure that people get home safely. You know, even the get home text with the lady who, you know, got kidnapped.
Sarah
that whole aspect that someone actually had asked her that question, and still that had happened. It's not something in which I look at and go, I can't believe that happened. It's just the general respect for women and non-binary people within society, I guess, that just needs to be rectified. And I think even in that situation with such a big DJ, how many people have probably come forward and said something? But because it's him, people were like, oh, but you know,
when it's a superstar, he
wouldn't do that.
Well, they're kind of enablers, really, aren't they? All the people around them, you know, they're enabling him to carry on behaving like
that. Turn a blind eye.
Yeah, they just turn a blind eye because of who people are. And this has happened all the way throughout history, really. And there's just so much. I feel like there's just so much to dismantle.
Yeah.
There's so many systems that we just need to dismantle and start looking at them again. And, you know, even just sort of simply even at Fabric, I think we kind of are a safe space. But like you said, there's always people that ruin that kind of space. And we've still got a lot to learn. And that's what we've been doing in this lockdown as well, is like thinking about how we can make sure that the experience you come to the club is completely 100% safe for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I think all clubs and spaces, they need to look at recruiting. It starts with like your staff, the behind the scenes and seeing things. And as I said, keep saying about visibility, it's like you have to see people like yourself. And you're like, we're taking advice from the LGBTQ community. And, you know, what do we need to do to make sure that you're safe if you're coming to our club? You know, what kind of things we do, and listening to them. And that's what I think everybody needs to take on board to try and make their spaces safer.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
I think also this is why Sherelle's point about ownership is so important, you know, going forward, that ambition to actually own these places, and then you can set the agenda.
Then you can set your own agenda.
Yeah, completely.
Absolutely.
And you can clear out all the shit from the past and just say, do you know what, we're starting again at this moment, and this is how we're going to roll in this place.
So, yeah.
You know, that's the way we're doing it. Like it or clear off, you know. And that's a really powerful thing.
Mm.
I'm thinking about the dubstep community that I was very much involved with.
Yeah.
And I guess in those very tiny embryonic scenes, there's a different kind of relationship between people, really. It felt like a family. It was wonderful, you know. And right at the very epicenter of that scene was an amazing woman called Sarah Lockhart. And she's now head of A&R at Sony, actually. But at the time, she established the record label Temper. She put together Forward the Club Night. And she was also heavily involved with Rinse alongside Genius. And they created the campaign to win the license. And she is one of the most influential people that I know. But there were so many women involved with that scene, actually. An amazing woman that I used to call the Red Princess, a writer called Melissa Bradshaw, and a photographer, Georgina Cook, Drums of the South, who just documented that whole scene so beautifully. There was Steffi, who organised all the DMZ raves and was very much involved with the label, still involved with Deep Medi now. Yeah. And also Amy, must shout out Amy. She was on the door at Forward always. And I mean, the scene was so small. I'm thinking back to the days that I first saw Scream playing at Forward. There were three people in the room.
No way.
And that was Scream's girlfriend at the time, Charlotte, Hatcher, who's another DJ, and the barman. And that was it, you know. And it still remains one of the greatest sets that I've seen of all time.
Where was that? What
that was at Forward at Plastic People. There was a kind of sense that everybody in that very small community had a different role, you know. And we did move very much like a family. And I remember the first time Mala booked a coach to go up to Leeds. And it just felt like we were changing the world. You know, the idea that Iration Steppers would book DMZ at the West Indian Centre to play Room 2, you know, and we all jumped on this coach, went bumbling up the motorway up to the West Indian Centre. And I don't know, everybody took great care of one another. You know, there was that real sense of community.
Yeah.
And I think also that was because at that point, really, the music, so much of it was unreleased. It was right on the cusp of the internet beginning to break. So MySpace was coming into play and you had the dubstep forum and stuff like that. But for the main part, only a fraction of this music was ever released. And obviously, if you got a booking at one of the big clubs, so DMZ or Forward, it was such a big deal for the producers. And they used to build loads and loads of new tunes and cut them onto dubplate. But they would be the only people who had the dubplates. Maybe Youngster, who was another big DJ in the scene, had a lot of dubs. And then I would get a file usually to play on the radio, you know. But what was so beautiful about that time was that if you wanted to be involved as part of that community, you had to be present in the clubs because that would be where you were going to hear the music. You couldn't get it anywhere else. Yeah. And I think that was why that sense of family became so strong. You know, Code 9, all the Hyperdub family, obviously, just absolutely right at the epicenter of that scene, really, too. And I feel that those bonds and those types of relationships have proliferated over the last 15 years,
you know,
and they're still just as equally as strong, you know. And I almost can conceive of that as a way in which, I don't know, beautiful might unfold for a new generation with that sort of sense of family at the epicenter, that sense of everybody looking out for each other, mm-hmm. and that sense of real passion and respect for one another, right across cultures, across genders. Yeah. And yeah, it was a beautiful kind of utopian time in a way, to use the name of your podcast.
That sounds gorgeous. Were there any moments ever where you felt, I don't know, like maybe if you, because you traveled a lot as well as a woman, I don't know if you ever on your own or just surrounded by guys, but was there ever times where you felt uncomfortable in that sense?
Not with that community, no. I have to say, I feel really privileged to have been accepted into that world. And, you know, it's kind of interesting even to, you know, when I look at the way that Burial moved, that was a really exciting thing to watch as well, because there were only a couple of people who really knew what he looked like. So it was me, Martin Clark and Code 9, and that was about it. Wow. So even as he began to, you know, break as a really big star, he was able to move around in the clubs where his music was actually being played, but in a completely anonymous way. Nobody knew who he was. So he could test his own music on these massive rigs without being besieged. And there was a kind of element of that as well that I, reflecting on it, that I think has been really successful for him, as just the beautiful, quite introverted soul that he is, you know. He wasn't the sort of person that you could ever have put into a live environment. He's never played a gig ever once. And he's not the sort of person that you could ever, I suppose, put into the very tempestuous environment of social media, because he's, I don't know, I'm not going to say fragile, that's the wrong word. I'll just say introverted as a human being, but absolutely pure and beautiful soul. And I always thought there's a lot to learn by the way that Burial has chosen to move as well, you know, with great stealth and quietly, and allowing the work to speak for himself. And I realise that doesn't work for everybody, but I don't know, it's certainly one really interesting pathway. But anyway, there are my dubstep stories.
Oh, I love that.
No, it's true though about the communities, because I feel like it was like that with dance music in the early days as well. It's like we were all one big family and sort of community, which still is now, don't get me wrong, but we used to be a bit surprised that in the last sort of, say, 10 years, if someone sort of gets into trouble and they go to the paramedics, or, you know, they're not feeling too good, they've drunk too much or whatever, the amount of times in the last few years where it would be like suddenly the friends had disappeared or they lost their friends, that story all the time. And I was like, when we used to go out, we'd go out in like crews, there's just like no way like my friends would have left me. You know what I mean? There was always someone in your crew that was the person that, no matter how wasted they got, they were still going to look out for you. We all looked out for each other. You know, there was no way you were going to get in that cab home without your mate, unless you knew where they were, what they were up to. And it was just sort of so fickle that, you know, what we notice is that this is happening a lot lately. It's like, where are your mates? Oh, I don't know, I haven't seen them for hours. Or, you know, just been wandering around the club on your own or something. It's like, wow, what's happened? You know, where's the love? I think this is the thing. Love needs to kind of like soar again. That's what this our community was built on.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I'd love to build on that and just hear from you guys what you think those big changes that you've seen over the years have been.
I think for, I guess, our generation, we've been via social media pretty much half of our lives. So I do see that where people have left each other, and like there's just like some lone person just walking down the street. But there's, for some strange reason, I think that the intimacy between our generation is like, well, they're on this.
They're on the phone
and stuff, or they're on the laptop, that thus meaning they're going to be fine because they're just gonna upload a picture of it. I seen their story like an hour ago.
Yeah, so true.
you know, they were fine an hour ago. And obviously, you know, we're aware of obviously lots can happen in an hour. And I think there's definitely still love very much for everyone. I just think that we go by, if their story's still going 2 minutes later, then they must
and
be fine.
And you can be there for someone by talking to them online. Do you know what I mean? It's different now, whereas years ago you'd be there for someone because you'd be physically with them.
Yeah. Well, the only way you could, I guess, talk to them was via, like, you know, like the house phone and stuff. I was going to say that sometimes I think people are more concerned with, like, the moment than the actual, like, actually, like, being present. And sometimes I think if a friend has, like, got too drunk or had far too many pills or whatever, like, some people are like, oh, for fuck's sake, this person's ruined the night. Just put them in the cab or send them off that way. And then, you know, because we're actually more concerned about sometimes being very much looking at the DJ, which I think is obviously a very new thing. Like, I can imagine, obviously, people didn't really give a fuck about where the DJ was in the booth. They were just dancing in it. And now it just feels like when you're DJing and stuff, like, people are just staring at you with their phones and stuff.
I guess, well, it's definitely one thing that's changed, isn't it? It's like, in nowadays, your music's sort of not enough anymore. Whereas, like, you know, when we started, like, it was just like, this is a good DJ or it's not a good DJ, you know, and you book them. But now it's sort of, you kind of have, you're forced to have a presence and a profile.
That's very true.
And
That you might not necessarily, like you're saying about Burial, you know, he's not that sort of artist. He's not, just because you make music doesn't mean that you know how to push yourself or see yourself. And a lot of producers I know, they're not successful because they don't want to play the marketing thing. They don't want to have to put themselves out there. They're like shy, introvert people who want to just be in the studio and make good music and hope that it gets out there. But they don't necessarily want to build followers and build a page and all of that, you know? And that's something that's changed drastically. Yeah. It was never so important before to what your actual image was like. And sometimes that image can take over your skill.
Yeah,
it can grow faster than the actual skill of the person. So.
Yeah, it's a weird one, especially I think with women, that can definitely be the case and stuff. My partner wore a mask for a considerable amount of their career. No one
really
knew who they were. And then
to be anonymous.
Absolutely, so they can listen to the music.
Mm.
It's pretty straight up and straightforward. That, you know, sick and tired of potentially any sort of comments that could be coming in about their appearance and stuff like that and whatever. And I think you shouldn't have to do all these things because I guess it's more, well, realistically, all of us are here very much for the music.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the main component. Do you know what I mean? It's like, rather than having to market yourself and all this kind of stuff, the main component should be the music.
Skepta tried a really interesting thing actually a couple of years ago at Manchester International Festival, and he did a show where he stipulated that you could not bring a phone. So either you left your phone at home or you checked your phone in at the door and you didn't get it until after the show. And it was wild, actually. I realised that I hadn't been out, I don't know, maybe for a decade or longer without a phone. And I elected to just leave it at home. But he really changed the dynamic in the room that night, and it took me back to those early days.
Yeah,
and I thought, wow, this feels absolutely wild because everybody is laser focused on Skepta's performance and they're not thinking about something that they need to capture for Instagram.
Exactly. That's kind of what we've done, the policy at Fabric. We've just
Yes, of course.
The thing is, it's like, there always was a no photos rule at Fabric, like always from day one. And, you know, if you came in with a camera, it would get put into the cloakroom or put away in security. And it would only be authorised photographers that would take photos. But just obviously in the last, I don't know, maybe decade, maybe less, it just got hard to police. We just couldn't police it anymore. It would be like, literally, I would get abused. I would go onto the dance floor and complain to people if they were sort of like standing around the DJ, and it just like would be sometimes a big DJ, but it'd be like a flash of light constantly while they're trying to play. And it's like, I'd go around and go, look, guys, it's fine. You get one photo, but seriously,
there'd
be people standing there with like iPads, like literally like that all night long. You're like, are you for real?
It's
like, seriously. And you'd go around there and complain and they would scream, shout at you. They'd be like, just could not understand what you were talking about. It's like, how would you like it if you were sat at your desk and someone just shone a light in your face the whole time you were working? you know, you wouldn't like that. So why should you expect the DJ to do that while they're working?
It is insane
as well.
It's
just too intrusive. And yeah. So, I mean, it's not that we don't want anyone to have a phone. I mean, it's going to be hard. It is going to be still hard to police it. But I don't mind if you're going to take a photo at the bar or in one of the rooms. Like, but on the dance floor, no.
Leave it.
Just leave it. I want people to just stay in the moment and enjoy it. And also, I think, like, by doing it, one of the things about sort of in the early days of there not being that option to take photos and stuff, you never even thought about it when you're on the dance floor. Even if I used to take my camera out on a very rare occasion, I would it would stay in my bag all night because I could never remember to bother to get it out, you know? And so I think that kind of gave you a little bit more of sort of a safety element as well. You know, you knew that you were going out and you were going to escape. There's no one, you aren't going to see some picture of you completely wasted, like online the next morning, you know? You weren't going to see in some uncompromising position or something, you know? You didn't have to take that risk. And that's what I think is sort of we need to bring back. You know, people need to be able to express themselves on the dance floor and not know that someone's going to take a picture of them and it's going to end up somewhere. You need to have more control of your sort of space. And that's kind of like the reasoning sort of behind reiterating it now after lockdown. We're like, you know what, let's reclaim our space, basically.
Yeah. You'll notice more people nursing their friends back to health in the
not leaving them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, because they've got they just assume that they can contact them on the phone.
Yeah.
So it's like that moment aspect of must catch the moment. It's like how many different slides on an Instagram story of videos that you're never going to watch and probably have
to
delete.
Well, that's it. It's like half the time you're not going to watch it again. Yeah. It's like some grainy video of like, it's really dark. It's like hardly anyone there. And then you end up with all these videos online. Yeah. Really crap.
That's how I feel about fireworks. Like, I never film fireworks because it's like, no, but if you know, it's like a really beautiful firework display. I don't know. I love fireworks.
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you? But people do, like, you're
they
with
do,
them,
yeah.
Get their friends, like, they'll last, like, 5 minutes.
That's
and
the worst thing.
I think they're the most beautiful thing in the world. And I never film
when they're about that moment
what's
and that
the point?
Time.
Who cares if I'm watching fireworks? Like, do you care if you saw that on my story? No. Like, it's pointless. No.
I think as well, I don't know, it is a spiritual place, isn't it, the dance floor, really? Mm. It used to be in our generation.
Definitely.
And it was a place that you could escape from the chaos of the world, and you could find a kind of, I don't know, a cerebral sense of peace in spite of the fact that you were surrounded by music and bodies and chaos. There was a sense of peace that you could arrive at within yourself in the middle of a dance floor. And that sense of escapism, I think, is incredibly important. It certainly was in my life. Mm. And it did used to feel like, in a way, it was like going to church, going to DMZ.
It really was, yeah.
And I remember before I ever really knew anybody there at all, it's funny, actually, the story. It was a Bristol artist called Pinch. I found his very first 12-inch and I thought, oh my gosh, what is this sound? I can hear the component parts, but this is a new interpretation. And I remember it was pouring with rain and I was on the top of a double-decker bus in King's Cross and I rang up Pinch and I said to him, what is this music that you're making on my Nokia phone? And he said, well, it's called dubstep, and if you really want to figure out anything more about this, you know, you need to go to a club called DMZ and you need to find a guy called Mala, which is exactly what I did. But I used to go in the early days. I didn't know anybody at all, actually, nobody. But I used to feel this incredible sense of peace in the middle of that space, just on my own, you know, with the music and all my troubles, which were many actually at that point, just dispersing in that moment.
Completely.
But I feel if at that point, you know, I'd have had a fabulous Apple phone in my hand, the experience would have been entirely different, I think, probably. So, yeah. Maybe put the phone down for a bit and see how you get on.
I mean, it's been really well received, us sort of reiterating it to people. It's been way more well received than we thought. I mean, of course, there's some people going, why are you doing that? Why can't we have a phone? But it's just like, we're like, it's been really well received, but let's see what the reality is
it
when
goes,
it actually opens. But, you know, I think people may well respect it now. I think
especially
that
after being
ready for that
for
with
so long. We, you know, people are going to be really, I hope, really want to get back into the rave.
Absolutely.
And just make the most of it.
Yeah.
You would think.
You witnessed a lot of horror. I mean, for me anyway, I witnessed a lot of horrors via my phone. recently, obviously, with if you go back to like BLM and stuff, yeah, like just, via your phone, it's just there.
You can be scrolling and then...
No. So I'm more, you know, more than happy anyway to not have it, because I think it just can bring a whole lot of anxieties. You've got emails on there, you've got messages, you've got WhatsApp, and you've got all the various different social medias.
I feel like possibly also all of us have been in a situation where we have been on the receiving end of a lot of abuse on social media. And do you know what? I wanted to share this today if there was an opportunity to do it, because I thought it was really useful. I have a friend in America who's very famous, and he was getting absolutely torn to shreds on social media. And I had a conversation with him about what was happening, and he used this brilliant expression. He used the expression internet turbulence. And I went away and thought about it, and I thought essentially what he's trying to communicate to me is the fact that if you decide to get on a plane, once that vehicle is up in the air, it's subjected to all kinds of forces that are way beyond anybody else's control, weather systems, whatever it may be. But obviously you've decided that you want to make the journey. You're getting on that plane. You want to go to New York or Barcelona, wherever you're going to go. So you have engaged with it. And I thought, I tried ever since that conversation to think about social media in that context, thinking, okay, if I choose to engage with this, I know that there's a lot of really hostile, aggressive, racist, sexist, misogynistic, bigoted forces on the internet. That's just the nature of the space. So in a way, it helps me to kind of detach my emotion from it, because I just think what you're dealing with is a space that is already conceived of in this way and is very, very difficult to marshal. So it helped me to just look at social media like a tool. So I just use it when I want to platform something that I think is important, that I think is wonderful. Like yesterday, I posted about the fact that we got your single on the playlist, which I was so pleased about. But beyond that, it's really helped me to sort of separate out my emotional connection with social media. And it just, I don't know, I just thought it's such a simple phrase, internet turbulence. But I thought, yeah, I like that. It works for me, you know.
Like you've only got one, though. You've only got Twitter.
Yeah, I can't cope with the rest.
I've got Instagram. The kids at Fabric made me a Insta page about three or four years ago. And I've probably made about five posts in that whole time. I'm like a sort of annual post. You know, if I really, really, really want to say something, then like... I'll put it on there, but it's mainly sort of, it's kind of turned into a little bit of a, my friend passed away a few years back, and it sort of turned into a little bit of a tribute for him, because every year I post something about him. And then there's maybe a few things like the Black Lives Matter sort of comment when I was so horrified. So I thought, I've got to get some of this out, you know. And I did actually, after last year, I did sort of think, you know what, maybe you should use your platform more. Maybe you should, like, you know, after me venting the way I felt after the George Floyd thing, I thought, you know, maybe I need to sort of do this more, and people need, you know, hear what I say and just get it off my chest. But yeah, I haven't got Facebook. I've never had that
before.
You've
probably got the right idea, to be honest, GD. Like, it's, you could literally, like this morning, I was going to have like a really productive morning, and then I just went on my phone, annoyingly, like when I was in bed, and then I was literally just on my phone.
You're on it,
all
yeah.
morning, wasted the whole morning.
I'm an Insta voyeur. I'm that person that just sort of like looks at other people's pages occasionally see what everyone's writing and do what everyone's up to. But I don't actually personally post myself very often. I might do it a little bit more. I think people should just sort of use their platforms to sort of educate or elevate. Yeah. If you're not doing one of those two things, then
oh my God, yeah,
what's the point? Do you know what I mean?
I feel like we're coming to a close. I think I'll just ask our final question, which I ask everyone who comes on the podcast. And that is, what is your utopia and how are we going to get there? What does it look like?
I guess my utopia is where sort of things like inclusion and diversity and equality are just normalized, you know, and that we kind of like people start ripping up the rule book, changing the narrative and, get on with doing things in a much more sustainable way. Like, that's what I would like to see, not just in Clubland, but just in the world in itself. Mm. Like, those kind of values, like, coming to the fore and people, like, really doing the work, because there is a lot of work to do from people. And I think a lot, I think one of the things about sort of striving for equality and all those things, it, like 100%, is that people are not prepared to do the work. And there is a lot to do. We have a lot to dismantle. There's so many systems, from like the penal system to the NHS and hospital systems. We love you, NHS. But you still have a system that needs dismantling. The courts, all of these things, sort of, we need to change the way that we think about stuff.
Yeah.
And nice. So that kind of a world is my utopia, I think, is like, you know, where I don't have to sort of make excuses for sort of who I am. And you know, I can, that everybody can just be, everyone can just exist.
Yeah.
I think that's my utopia. Really.
Sounds great. Great place.
Somewhere where love wins.
Yeah. Marianne, what's your utopia?
I think it is all about sharing the love, if you want to atomize it, isn't it? And conversations like this are really, really important. Bringing women together like this to talk about their stories is so important. And then, I don't know, it's doing what all four of us, I think, have done all our lives, isn't it? We see a chink of light and we see something that looks great and we see people that we can help. And we see a positive direction that we want to move in, which does move us towards more equality and sustainability. And we imagine the kind of future that we want to build. And then we go out proactively and make that happen every day. And there are a lot of things that need to change. And but I believe that things change incrementally. And it's wonderful to have utopian dreams, and I think we should all aim really high, but every single step along the way, along that pathway, is an important one. Mm-hmm. So thank you for bringing us together today.
Oh my God, thank you.
Yeah, it's been great.
It's been gorgeous. And Sherelle, we'll end with you then, your utopia.
I wish that Mary ended, actually, because I realised that I don't, yeah, ending in such a nice, beautiful, poetic way is not necessarily my
go on
strong point. I think if I had a utopia, it would be basically taking, obviously, both parties have said, I would obviously love to see a bit more intersectionality of things. I think that's so desperately needed anyway in the world that we live in at the moment anyway. So in my utopia, there would be aspects of that. I would desperately want it to be some form of like, I guess like safe haven. I'd want people to be able to express themselves freely. I'd want to get rid of obviously binaries, because I think that those are the kind of things that they don't sometimes allow for progress in the sense of things. I'm not talking about, you know, is it yes or is it no? It's more to do with just, you know, general being, and how like sometimes having binaries actually is like, this is evil and this is good. I'd want to kind of get rid of that. And I would want to obviously my place to be a good place, just to stress. But I also wouldn't want someone to sit there and be like, well, I am this person and I do this and this and this. I think obviously we live in a lot of like different binaries as people anyway. And I'd want someone to really express themselves for who they are, which obviously you do see within the trans community and the non-binary community and stuff like that. I would obviously just, yeah, expressing yourself. Yeah, like just having some actual love there and actually just having the freedom to kind of do what you want without having to think too deeply maybe about what the job or what something does in order for you to gain or anything like that. Don't know. Yeah, I just like it to be happy and no police. Yeah. So, you know, I would trust in the fact that people obviously would be nice enough to people. I don't want people getting in their heads already trying to categorize themselves as better than, because we realistically should just all be on the
same level.
The same level, and then also appreciate and listen and respect each other. So yeah, no police and all of the above.
Amazing. Thank you guys so much. I feel like for me, like this is my utopia. I live for these conversations, and it's a real honor to have the three of you and the four of us in this room. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having us.
Sharing a room with Judy, Sherelle and Marianne and having the space to discuss these topics was incredible. I'm feeling so inspired after hearing their stories, and I'm really excited to see their careers continue to reach crazy heights. Big thank you to Katie Baxter for producing this episode. And once again, let me know what you thought. I'm at Jaguar Worldwide. Tag me, let me know. I'd love to hear from you, and we will see you in the next episode.
Utopia Talks is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.